Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, and that's a channel on the New Books Network. And I'm here today with Dr. John Davis, who's the author of a new book on cholera epidemics in Russia. So thanks for being with us today, John.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
You bet. So can you start us off with a little biographical information, how you got interested in Russian history in general, maybe cholera specifically, where you went to school, who you studied with, things like that?
Well, I was originally a police officer, and after a career doing police, I become interested in Russian history, interestingly enough, just sort of on my own, reading books and watching documentaries and this sort of thing. And so I decided to become a teacher, went to Northern Kentucky University and got yet another degree, this time in history, and applied and was accepted at the University of Kentucky in the graduate school program down there to work with Karen Petrone. And as you know, went to school down there from 2003 to right around 2011 and got my PhD in Russian history, also with European history and environmental history. So I become interested in disease really along the way after my thesis topic petered out as a potential doctoral topic. I read Death in Hamburg by Richard Evans and became very fascinated with the idea of cholera as a historical agent, and decided right then and there that that's what I would do my dissertation on.
So, you know, some people might find disease to be sort of an odd thing to be interested in, you know, but I guess that's probably true of any topic you get that deep into. So I was wondering, because I didn't really know when I started reading your book, like, could you just explain what kind of disease is cholera? Like, what I was really wondering is, what's it actually like to die from cholera?
That's a great idea. And that is part of the allure of cholera, actually, is how you die from it. It is a bacterial disease. It's caught through the oral fecal route. And the bacteria is known as the Vibrio. It used to be called the cholera comus. It actually looks like a comma under the microscope. But it is a very deadly disease. And when it gets, and it takes quite a bit of bacteria to make you sick enough to die. But when you get a large dose of this stuff, it basically within about anywhere from 2 to 8 hours, you could be dead. And it starts sucking the water out of you and dehydrates you in massive form from just about every angle that you can imagine that water can leave your body. And you, if you've ever had a cramp, you can imagine the cramping up of all your muscles at one time. It was a very morbid way to die, and it was a horrible, painful death. The eyes would sink back in the head. The body would turn blue, and it's known as the blue death, cholera. But it was a terrible way to die, and there were millions of people who died from this over the course of the 19th century, well over 2 million Russians. And of course, the statistics were always low because the medical authorities wanted to keep it that way. But it was a very painful death. And at times, even after the person was dead, the body would move because of the muscular contractions in the body. So it was a very eerie, scary thing.
Well, it's like that old Irish drinking song, "The Night Pat Murphy Died," where he sits up in the coffin afterwards. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And in fact, one year they had they took, you know, in Russia, of course, vodka is a big thing, and they had a toast over the body, and they didn't realize that their friend had drank from, and then there were a couple more
funerals. Oh no!
So it was a very deadly disease.
You made a point in the book of talking about cholera's origins down in and around India, and I thought maybe it might be helpful to the audience if you could do some background on where cholera is endemic to, so then to kind of set up the background for talking about Russia specifically.
Absolutely, Aaron, and this is one of the reasons that Russia was so vulnerable to cholera was because of its location to the north of India. India is endemic. Cholera is endemic in India primarily just because of the physical layout. You have the tallest peaks in the world, the Himalayas, and then you have these river valleys and streams running down off of the Himalayas, capturing all types of bacteria along the way, running down into the Indus and the Ganges River Valley, and down, and especially the Ganges, which is considered the home of cholera, into the Bay of Bengal in that area there, and out into the bay. Cholera, it's really endemic to estuaries, places where rivers come together with the sea, where salt water and fresh water, so-called brackish water, come together. You have processes there, and especially when weather-related events shake up these areas. It's also not that far from Indonesia, where you have most of the volcanoes, the really more massive volcanoes. I think the first three or four largest volcanoes in history were in the Sunda Arc right there of Indonesia. So this place is just a manufacturing manufacturer's delight for cholera. It's made for that, and so that's really why. And of course, it attacks people who live and are vulnerable to high water. You have disruption of the monsoon there due to weather related events. Or people who are suffer from famine. As you know, they have 1.3 billion people there. I'm assuming they had probably a billion then. And if you have the monsoon, if you have disruption in the monsoon, you have hunger, and then you have a lot of these people, and then you have these torrential downpours where all this water comes off of Mount Everest. So this is going to be an area that is very susceptible to disease.
So what do the volcanoes have to do with it specifically?
Well, the volcanoes are thought to have a correlation with the El Nino,
okay.
The teleconnection across the Pacific, which starts it up. It's partly the difference in the heat or the cold, but usually it's the El Nino and it's the heat across the Pacific, which, you know, causes reactions, the so-called butterfly effect, where a butterfly flaps his wings on one side of the world and you have an incident on the other. But and there's also a belief that there's a salt conveyor underneath it, and so salt has something to do with it. But you have these volcanoes which shift the tides in the bay. And in the estuaries, they more or less stir up the bottom sediments of the estuaries. Plus, you have temperature changes in the saline solutions in the estuaries, which rattle up these cholera microbes, they sit there actually in an incomplete form, and this sort of activates them. And then you have a small crustacean called copepods who bring these things. They are actually able to live in aerobic and anaerobic environments. So they come up from these anaerobic environments to aerobic environments, are eaten by larger crustaceans, larger shellfish, And then in times of famine, who is going to eat them but human beings? So this is how it's believed to, or one of the main ways it's believed to start. And that is what the volcanoes do. They just sort of get all these processes going.
So you also, correct me if I didn't read your book correctly, but I got the impression that the cholera bacteria actually mutates. And so like Russian cholera is different than Indian cholera, or German cholera was different than Russian cholera. Did I get that right?
Well, it's something like that. It's something like that, Aaron, because in Indonesia, the Bay of Bengal is supposed to be in the home for V. cholerae 01, with the so-called Koch's Vibrio, the Vibrio that Robert Koch isolated, which was a very strong Vibrio. A newer Vibrio, which was found by a fella in 1905, the El Tor Vibrio, is actually believed to be endemic in Indonesia, and they spread out more. But this is actually a weaker Vibrio, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily less deadly. It could actually kill a lot of people because you have it survives more because it's weaker. It kills less host, so it's more pervasive. Although it doesn't, we've not seen the El Tor epidemics in the West. They generally go to Russia and places like that, and just have not penetrated Western Europe and the Americas. Fortunately for Western Europe and the Americas, and that is still a danger today, very much.
So that'd be kind of akin then to the difference between the bubonic and the pneumonic plague, where even though the pneumonic plague is deadlier, it actually kills fewer people because it kills people so quickly. Is that a good enough analogy there?
Absolutely, absolutely. Really, it's evolution is what it is. It's the same species. It's just evolved into a state where it's going to survive, where the other species are not always active. They do live in these bays, but they can come back. Actually, local conditions, including whether people have been eating or not, the hunger of the people, the insides of the people, determine how these microbes can survive and can evolve and how an epidemic can start. So it even has to do with epigenetics, where epigenetics being, applied characteristics possibly over time, where the Chinese have their ancestors starved and three generations become susceptible to disease. That is believed. That's a current theory. And I think it probably holds true, certainly for India and China, and maybe even for Russia.
So something else that played quite an important role in the book there was you were sketching out the differences over the course of the 19th century between the German and French schools of thought on cholera. I was wondering if you could kind of sketch out what the German approach to cholera was and what the French approach to cholera was.
Well, the French approach is started earlier, actually. It comes from Louis Pasteur, who was really the first or one of the first folks to work with vaccination on, and he worked on chicken, so you hear chicken cholera. But he was very good about his theory. Of course, he's the guy who invented fermentation. So he likened it to fermentation and thought of it as a process that probably occurred in the ground between compounds, which would activate it and accelerate it, like fermentation. So it's activity with other compounds would get the cholera activated. Koch in Germany, on the other hand, really was more of a laboratory scientist who just looked at it under the microscope with new microscopes in the 1880s and was able to identify the Vibrio. Although you had already had a fellow by the name of Filippo Puccini in the 50s who had an Italian who had identified it. In fact, he gets most of the credit now. But Koch believed that this Vibrio could be isolated, that that it was really just passed from people to people, whereas Pasteur had an idea that an environmental idea. He's not known for that. He's thought of as a bacteriologist, but he really had an environmental idea, which he got from really the reigning paradigm at the time. A fellow by the name of Eustace Liebig had looked at disease, and he thought that it was a process diametrically opposed to life. Pasteur proved that was not true, and that it was vital components that were moving around. You know, there's no spontaneous generation. The things are alive. And in the middle of these two, you have Liebig's protege, Max von Pettenkofer, who come up with the formula X plus Y equals Z. You have X, which is a cholera, and Y, some unknown substrate, and that it runs into an environmental effect, and then Z, the epidemic itself. So, but the difference is really the anti, if you believe Cook, if you believe it's always passed from humans, then it can be isolated. It can be quarantined. It can be kept out of a location, which I think is true. I mean, Evans wrote the book on death in Hamburg. Hamburg is a northern port, pretty distant from India, and you probably can isolate it up there. But it's much harder to isolate it in Russia, which faced so many threats. When you have the commerce coming from India to the West and up the Volga River, it has so many large rivers and passages. Isolating and using quarantine to stop the Vibrio in Russia becomes a much more of a task, an almost impossible task, actually.
So tagging on to that, Dan, is that primarily what for Russian medical researchers, that's what makes the French school of thought on cholera more appealing than the German?
It does. And of course, the French had and the Russians had a connection also, right? I mean, they worked in the same laboratories. You had I.I. Mishnikov, who invented who was one of the founders of immunology, who also had this fight with some of the Germans over immunology, mostly Ehrlich, Paul Ehrlich. And there's fights between these, you know, there's academic fights between these schools of thought. Pasteur and the Germans had no love for each other. So the Russians kind of sided with the French. I mean, Pasteur brought to a lot of Russians like N.F. Hamileya, Mishnikov, and others from the Odessa school. They're all out of Odessa, which Mishnikov and a fellow by the name of I.U. Bardek started. And they formed an alliance, and their thinking was very similar. And this certainly profoundly influenced them, particularly in Russia, where cholera is clearly an environmental disease. It's pervasive in the environment. So it's interesting that they gravitated to the French school, which was the correct school of thought for them, for a variety of reasons. And the German school, which is further north, and just, although they actually did experience cholera in 1905, they actually had some later outbreaks there. But the idea was, well, they just formed a land quarantine, which they did, and defeated cholera after 1892, and the Russians didn't. So the Russians must be backwards. But this was not the case at all. The Russians had a much greater and more pervasive threat, and that's why.
Something I was kind of following up on that, something I was quite curious about was, as I was reading your book and you were talking about the influence of the French school of thought in Russia and the back and forth between the scientists and so on. I mean, those fights almost exactly mirror the political relation between Russia and France and Germany at the time, right? We had Russians and the Germans at odds over Pan-Slavism in Southeastern Europe and so on. Then, of course, the Franco-Russian alliance there in the 1890s. So does that, like, does the political relations between those three places, like, does that play any role in what scientific paradigm gets adopted in Russia, or is that just kind of parallel developments?
I think they're related, but not strongly. But I do think that you're onto something there. I mean, I talk about really the whole epic begins when you have the Tambora volcano and the surrender of Napoleon within a month of each other, and it kind of so there is that. Richard Evans talks about that in his book, this competition in India between the cooks and the pasteurs, the French and the Germans. And the Russians did seem to just naturally side with the French, although they found themselves on the opposite side of from the French during the war and over the Crimean War. But I think there's parallels there, loose parallels, I would say.
I mean, one more question on the this kind of scientific paradigms at the time. You know, I thought often of Thomas Kuhn while reading your book, and something that occurred to me was, to what extent do you think that these kind of predominant German versus French paradigms, do you think on the whole that those were beneficial in trying to fight cholera in Russia? Or do you think that the fact that we have these schools of thought where people are at odds with one another, do you think that actually held the, you know, medical science back more than the opposite? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do, Aaron. That's an excellent question. I think it was beneficial in Russia. I think it gave the Russians the presence of mind in a day which really was known for bacteriomania after Koch's discoveries. And all you have to do is just get this microbe and keep it out of a place and by through quarantine and through isolation of patients, and you shouldn't have cholera. But fortunately for Russia, I think they had Pasteur school as well. Although I think the Russians, and they were very independent, but this naturally gravitated to Pasteur school, which was more amenable to environmental arguments and environmental analysis of cholera, which was the right thing to do in Russia, in my opinion. I think they were very smart about this and to withstand. I mean, because Koch was a giant. You know, to withstand the German school and actually fight with them. You have Metchnikoff fighting with them over immunization. Of course, Pasteur was a great ally for them. And I think this was the right paradigm for them. I think in the end, I believe that they were correct about this, although the Germans were correct about it in their nation, which was, you know, a little bit different climate, a little bit different location, and a different problem. So I think it worked itself out, but it's amazing how they fought over this without considering these things. But they just didn't know about, you know, what we know today about cholera.
So that said, then we've kind of been doing some background type discussion here. I mean, what are the different kinds of methods the Russians tried over the course of the 19th century to actually deal with cholera, right? We think we know about it theoretically. How do they try to put that into practice?
Well, they actually developed, a land quarantine, a system of a flexible system of quarantine. They used quarantine. They believed in it. They just didn't think that they could keep it out of their country. So they thought it was a good method. It was a way to wear it down. The Russians called it the Borba's cholera, the struggle with cholera. To them, it was a struggle, and they tended to view it in Darwinian terms. We have to wear it down. We have to defeat it. And they actually, by the time of the 20th century, you had people like L.A. Tarasevich, who was an absolute hero. All these guys had trained with Pasteur and in Odessa, and they said, well, we just have to wear it down. It's actually dying on its own, and we have to help it die on its own. So we will fight it wherever it is. We will respond quickly, and they would respond. They would feed people in areas that were under siege or where they suspected a cholera epidemic was going to happen. You got one or two cases, and they were there, and they were vaccinating or inoculating people like crazy, and they were feeding everybody. They were giving everybody emergency water, boiled water, and it was a reactive system. It actually goes back to the military, the Russian military in the 1830s. They were very good at at evacuation. And then Pirogov experimented with this at Sevastopol during the Crimean War. Is how, what do you do with all these bodies? How do you get them out of here? They became very good at evacuation and this sort of thing. And then, of course, as you know, during the World War I, you had the Union of Zemstvas, the Union of Towns, the so-called Zemgor, which, again, become very good at evacuations. They really averted a disaster in 1915 in which they had a massive retreat, as you know, from the Germans, really in danger of losing the entire war in 1915. And you had really a very slight cholera epidemic in Moscow that year. Part of that might have been because the famine was low, but they were very good at evacuation and they become very good at this sort of thing. And this, I think, had an effect on how they reacted to cholera. We'll just drop back and we'll you know, stop it where we can and drop back and respond to it where it is. They had no idea that you could go down to the border. They knew that wouldn't work, and I don't think it would have. I'm not sure it would even work today in Russia because you didn't have the fast communications. Although when communications sped up during the Soviet era, even when the Soviets started, you started having the surveillance state, right? Where they're opening people's mail, but they know more about what's going on. I mean, that's another issue altogether. But as communication increased, really the fight with cholera and stopping it became more effective. And I think that had a lot to do with it, as did vaccination, which clearly was shown to work. If you could get into a place, you had 6 month protection against cholera if you vaccinated everybody. And usually that was enough to where it would pass. Also, just feeding people in the 1920s during the NEP. And this really resonated with Lenin. You had the Pirogov Society during the Tsarist era trying to feed people. And the Tsar saying, this is not in your bailiwick, back off. You know, we have our statute. And they had some famine statutes that they tried to work. But during the Soviets, Lenin finally got to come to the ideas, we need to raise the level of life for people. For one reason, because they were in real danger of collapsing. And they raised the level of food. And they, of course, they have this, by this time, this system of response was perfected. And that's when cholera really disappeared in the Soviet Union. Although you did have an enormous outbreak in 1921 during the 1921 famine, which lasted a couple years through 23 and 24.
I want to kind of backpedal here for a second. I'm guessing most of the listeners probably won't be familiar with the Zemstvo reform. Could you elaborate on that and like what role the Zemstvos tended to play in fighting cholera specifically?
That's an interesting question. I'll answer it as well as I can because it's a tough question. The Zemstvas were local councils formed in the 1860s during the so-called Great Reforms after the Russians were defeated in the Crimean War, which was considered a disaster in Russia, that to lose this war. They knew that they couldn't win with the slave army, and so they freed the serfs. And then they began to really remodel their government, and they did an excellent job, I think. Of just, we've got to modernize. And one of the creations was the Zemstvas, which were local councils of basically gentry and muckety mucks. You even had a peasant council, as you might recall, and you had them at the gubernial level, which was like the state level. You had them at the local level. And they were actually all the stakeholders, usually the big wigs, to make decisions. And you had for a time you had physicians on it. I think later on they were kicked off of it for a while. But the Zemstvas were a good thing overall, I think, although they were controlled by the gentry, and this was a problem, particularly in rural areas. Now in Moscow, you had the Union of Zemstvas and the Union of Towns, and you had physicians like F.F. Erisman, who was a Swiss immigrant, who was one of the finest physicians and really understood cholera and was very influential, had superior powers of communication, and could really form a relationship with these people. That did not happen everywhere, though. Moscow was really... it was exceptional. And of course, out in some other areas, although in Saratov, I think they had a pretty good Zemstvo and really good communications, but it was much harder to get that type of cooperation. But during the war, it really came together during the 1915 and some of the battles from the front. It was a complete mess that they had, of course, but I think they did an admirable job of evacuating and trying to save a lot of lives. They had an absolute nightmare on their hands.
I think it might have been your third chapter. You discussed an incident where, if I read you correctly, it seemed like the state actually prevented famine relief because they were worried that the Zemstvo might get too much power. Did I read that correctly?
That's right, Aaron. Although it was the Pribyegov Society itself, which was the Pribyegov Society formed back, after the Great Reforms. N.I. Pribyegov is really the hero of Russian and Soviet medicine, and they had this idea, and this idea developed as far as the Great Reforms, and part of the idea of preventive medicine, which their whole system is based upon, that our people are starving to death. They're not dying of disease. You can't treat disease when people are starving to death. So they had to feed people, and they actually developed this idea that we'll feed people, to try to keep them healthy. And so you had this great famine in India, which goes up to from about 1897 to 1900, one of the most horrible famines really ever in history, the so-called Great Famine, in which there's some arguments by Mike Davis and others that this created the Third World, the imperial powers were partly to blame here, that taking all the everything out. Anyway, it was also related, of course, to the El Nino and the weather events. So the Russians knew that cholera was coming. And really, they weren't even thinking about cholera. They were just thinking about people eating. So you had the Pribyegov Society going to places like Ekaterinoslav province, places which were traditionally at risk from famine and from cholera. And they're feeding people, every way they can. And actually, the cholera doesn't even enter Russia in any type of force at all until 1904, and it enters late. So I think that you look at that, and when they were told by the government to stand down, and this actually was due to gentry interference and also government interference, I think. They didn't like these physicians getting too big for their bridges. They told them that's outside of your responsibilities. But I think that probably played a role. It certainly seems to, because just at about the time that these guys are told to stand down, then you have cholera in 1902. You have an epidemic at Astrakhan in 1902 where several people died. In 1904, however, it comes back in pretty good force in Saratov, but it hit late, like in October. But it was a pretty good epidemic. But and the local populace did a pretty good job of responding. So, yes, they didn't really get just slaughtered until 1907 and again in 1908, when you had the Great St. Petersburg epidemic, which was about equivalent to what happened in Hamburg in 1892, a really hardcore epidemic, about 7,000 cases, I think, at least.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you made this very interesting argument, or I thought it was quite intriguing, where you said that in the World War One era, you noticed that the same conditions that created the collapse of the monarchy also helped create further cholera epidemics. So, were you seeing this as kind of, cholera is sort of a metaphor for the health of the monarchy, or can you elaborate on the parallels here?
Yeah, Aaron, absolutely. Thank you. I think so. I really do. You have cholera. Really, I know of no cholera epidemics that did not follow famine. Just about everything I've ever looked at, if I looked hard enough, I found a famine. And famine certainly played a role in the fall of the monarchy. We know that it started March Revolution, whatever you prefer to call it, began with workers at the Putilov factory. So it had to do with the war, of course. They're protesting the war, but they're also protesting taxes and this sort of thing. And you have the ladies out there, and you have the bread riots, right? And one of our professors, Dr. Furlow, said, when the ladies go out there and start looking for food for the families, there's real hell to pay. I mean, this is how the French Revolution started, and this is how the Russian Revolution started. So absolutely, these are the same conditions that cause cholera. If people don't eat, you have all this breakdown of the crop system, and you have the breakdown of the health. I think it's absolutely related to immunity. If you don't have immunity, so it's no, and then you start having these riots or demonstrations where people spread it around more, but it's already there. This idea that demonstrations cause cholera are incorrect, in my opinion, but I think it is related. I think it is a symptom. It's something that they never really got off their back, and had they gotten it off their back, had they fed their people better, who knows? They might have still been around. That's iffy history, but I think so. So cholera outlived them, and the Soviets crushed it out pretty quickly. They understood that you had to feed their people. They had other issues, obviously. They may have even, engaged in some forced starvation. They did institute grain requisitioning, in which they took grain from people and. In warfare, people are always starved out. I mean, I'm not justifying it, but I think the Soviets were far more adept in dealing with this and far more ruthless in some ways. And then when they thought that they were in danger of collapse, and they started feeding people, and this didn't hurt them at all.
So you made a point in the book of arguing that the medical science as far as how to deal with cholera was actually quite similar from the Tsarist era to the Soviet era. So could you elaborate a little more on, if that's the case, what did the Soviets do better than the Tsarist government did, finally stamping cholera out?
Well, that's a great question. What they did better is, for one, they used all the same guys, because it was the same people. It's the same, the Odessa group and people. They understood that these guys knew how to deal with disease. And they let them do their job. I think that was the main reason. And that they actually took it serious. They had the government took it serious. Lenin paid attention to this, where you had Nicholas out at Tsarskoye Selo, not even paying attention to the revolution. Lenin had his hand on things. And he said, I want to stamp this out. And he would ask, is there a cholera epidemic going on? I mean, he paid attention and he knew he had to listen to his physicians. He didn't particularly like his physicians very much, but he knew that he had to listen to them, and that these guys could stop cholera. And they did. And when he started listening to them, to what they said, and they were given the power to do what they needed to do, Then cholera was over very quickly. It was all the same people. Ilya Tarasevich, Himalaya, they called all the same people out. Some of them didn't quite, pass over. Zabolotnia, though, and the Odessa school, the same school that had been studying this for decades, now was empowered to stop it. And they picked the right people, actually, to do it. You did have people during the czarist period, like Vyazayev and others, who were adherents of Cook. But they never gained much traction out there because I think really because the other paradigm was the right paradigm for fighting cholera in Russia. I really believe that.
So was the period – so you mentioned earlier that there's the grain acquisitions in the early 20s during the war communism period and so on. So is the period – where, as you put it, Lenin really starts to take cholera seriously and try to attack it. That's the exact same period as NEP, right?
Aaron, absolutely. That's the whole entire philosophy of the Prigogov Society, preventive medicine, was totally compatible with the NEP, the new economic policy, in which they. You had to raise the level of the citizens. And when they did this, all the diseases really were they weren't wiped out, but they all fell. They had to do this because you had basically what was called the second time of troubles during 1918 through 21, where you had the largest typhus epidemic probably in history. You had cholera. I mean, cholera was the least of it. And you had the
flu.
The flu, of course, yes. So, it was like again, it was like one of these late Victorian Holocaust, and they were calling it the second time of troubles. And this is Lenin was no dummy. He knew we really have to do something here. This is a real crisis, and that he instituted the new economic policy, limited private market, brought back some capitalism. You know, he was a very pragmatic guy. He was not just a doctrinaire guy. But I mean, he knew if he didn't do this, they would collapse, and they were very close, I think, sometimes. But yes, and this preventive medicine, this whole idea, which had existed since the 1860s among the top physicians, was totally compatible with that. Yes.
So would it be going too far? Then I'm gonna see if I can stir something up here. Would it be going too far then to argue that the Soviet Union was able to stamp out disease to the extent that it compromised its own economic principles? And as far as you know, like as you put it a second ago, letting some capitalist profits accumulate during the NEP and so on.
Absolutely. I think I don't know too many historians who do not believe that the NEP was probably one of the best periods that the Soviets ever had.
Yeah.
So and they did it by compromising their principles. Sure. They it was not communism for that. That's for sure. It was a mixed economy. And I think there's a lesson here probably for a lot of governments that to get caught up on any particular ism is not a good thing. I mean, use what works. But they definitely compromised for sure on their principles. And that is definitely what's part of what saved them from cholera and a lot of other diseases and may have saved them in general, actually. Yes.
So something, I think this was just because your book ended where it did, but I'm really curious to know, given how you emphasize the importance of famine, both in the book and then here on the air as well. Did cholera come back during the Ukrainian famine?
Well, that's a good. Yeah, there was there was cases of cholera in Central Asia in the early 30s. It's interesting. I read once in one of the books that in 1927, cholera was liquidated, but it wasn't clear if cholera was liquidated or if statistics related to cholera was liquidated. There was some. Cholera in the 30s for sure. Because I've been interested in that question myself. And it did come back in the 1940s, of course, at Stalingrad. I mean, I guess they can be excused for that a little bit. But who did they call? They called M.F. Himalaya, a guy who had been battling cholera for 50 years to come to Stalingrad, a czarist physician. Because the czarist physicians knew it better. I mean, they'd just been fighting it longer and they were familiar with it.
Can I quote you on that in future, John, that they may have liquidated cholera or they may have liquidated cholera statistics?
You can absolutely quote me on that. I really wasn't, my Russian wasn't quite good enough to, I'm not sure what it said, but I really think they liquidated statistics. We know it came back again in the 60s, but it was mostly the El Tor. And the El Tor hit, and you don't hear a whole lot about cholera until Stalin dies, by the way. So I think the statistics were certainly liquidated during that era. But you get it again in 43. That's about the only time you hear about it. And then you start hearing about it, what, about 7 years after Stalin dies in 1960, you had an El Tor epidemic at the time of the interestingly enough, of the Lima, Peru earthquake. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I wouldn't be surprised. But they've wrestled with El Tor ever since. They even had some epidemics in the 90s. But these are not as explosive epidemics. They're not classical cholera epidemics, which, let me tell you, the disease in the 19th century, it would start out with a few cases and then it would just rise real rapidly. If you looked at it on a graph, it was almost a straight up and then sort of a peaking and then a falling off. And then they called it the long tail, the Delaney-Holst, in which there's just a spattering of cases near the end. So it looked like a big triangle with one side, and what one side was just, it dropped off and then just sort of went out to the right. I would have to draw it, I guess. I probably didn't describe that very well.
Yeah. So, You brought up an interesting argument here earlier when you mentioned that they viewed it as a struggle, you know, and of course then during the Soviet Union, lots of things become, you know, the struggle and so on, even if we're rejecting, Darwinian struggle. Not too long ago, I interviewed David Hoffman at Ohio State there, who you've worked with before, and his, I don't know if you've read Hoffman's new book or not, but Hoffman argued in the book, that the fact that the Soviet Union was born, in context of the First World War and the Civil War, that birth out of a physical struggle, didn't really kind of characterize the USSR's entire existence. And when I read your book, I was wondering if we should add the struggle against cholera to those other conflicts that Hoffman was talking about. I don't know. I don't know if you've read Hoffman's book or not, but what do you think about that idea?
I've not, but I get what he is saying is that the Soviet Union was born in this struggle, and that I'm not sure I understand the argument.
He's arguing that the way the state operated, as though it was kind of perpetually under siege all the time, that has its origins in the fact that it was born during states where it was under siege, in the First World War and in the Russian Civil War there. So I'm just wondering if when you kept talking about the struggle there against cholera, that sounded awfully similar to other official capital S struggles the state was engaged in throughout the existence of the Soviet Union. So I was just wondering if maybe we should see cholera as kind of, it should take its place among all of those other struggles, like against the Kulaks or against whoever the other enemies might have been. Am I making sense here?
Absolutely, absolutely. I totally agree with that. In fact, I've just been teaching the Cold War in my History 109 class, my American history course, and we were talking about George Kennan, who said that the Soviet philosophy needed to have a struggle. They have to have an enemy. It won't last unless it has an enemy, and it'll just wilt away. So he was just saying, kind of, you know, respond and you know, to crises, but don't stir anything up, and it thrives on that. And I think that's absolutely true. I think it was always like that. It was always a fight or a struggle, and they approached things like that. And sometimes they were very successful because of that. And of course, we pretty much know that Stalin was gearing up and for World War III. So that makes a lot of sense to me. David Hoffman is a very bright guy. I've talked to David a lot of times, and in fact, he kind of disabused me of the notion that I thought that during Stalin's era that this broad approach to public health kind of died, and he disabused me of that and said, no, it really hung around. And he really knows that era, especially about Stalin and during that era. So if he says it, I definitely believe it. And it makes sense to me, perfect sense.
So you raised another interesting issue of the relationship between the idea of the new Soviet man or woman, as the case may be, and public health. And you kind of indicated in the book that you thought you saw some avenues for future research questions here. Is that something you could comment on?
That's actually what I was just talking about. It's interesting that you say that. But I thought that the new Soviet person who can overcome basically anything, right, can overcome the environment, that Stalin really didn't want to hear that the environment was that important. And I've seen him say these sort of things that, well, really, the environment can be overcome, you know, and of course, the new Soviet person can overcome it, right? We can do anything we have to do. And this is where I thought they went back to laboratory research and we can defeat this and we don't have to pay attention to the environment. But apparently this broad approach to health did survive through that era. And you see them in the 60s still talking about, we took very broad methodology in trying to liquidate cholera. And they always use the word liquidation as well. But I think it did last. But I do think that public health during Stalin's era, I particularly on disease, I don't know if there's the archives or not, but I think it'd be an interesting study. The war kind of just takes all, World War II just kind of obliterates everything, I think. And on both sides in the 30s, and of course the 5-year plans in the 30s. But I think there is some room for research there if you were able to find the right archives.
What do you think accounts for the fact that, like you said, during the Stalin era, you thought that Soviet public health really kind of stayed the course and, you know, was pretty successful. Like, how do we square that with a phenomenon like Lysenkoism in Soviet biology, where, you know, all of a sudden we argue that you can inherit acquired characteristics because it would be really nice if the new Soviet man could do that? Like, how do we, what makes public health different, you think, where it's not quite as subject to, you know, ideological winds of the moment?
Well, I think it was subject to it to a degree, although I think the physicians and they've taken a bad rap that, you know, they just sort of follow the line, the party line. I don't think they always did that. You had the folks like Lysenko, who turns out to have had some ideas that which have found some resonance. You have a very partial rehabilitation of him recently here, but in some ways, according to some, and this is the so-called epigenetics, but I think it did follow the party line. Certainly who they chose, if they were not going to choose somebody, if they were telling them something they didn't want to hear, we know that. And that's where Lysenko was to guilty of even compromising his colleagues to where they would lose their life or something. It's getting a little bit out of my area there of expertise, but that was my idea that, well, this broad idea disappeared. And I believe David Hoffman, when he says that it stuck around, and I believe that you had physicians that would just say, look, that this is not true. I mean, that they would do the right thing. Of course, they were not the ones who moved up during that time.
No, I wouldn't think so. We're kind of running about to the end of our time here. What's What's the status of cholera in the world, say, like right now? I mean, is this something that just periodically kills a few people here and there? Is it something that's really more or less gone the way of diseases like polio? Or where are we at on that?
Oh, it's a scourge. It's an absolute scourge in Africa, in various places. And again, I think part of this is the biology there, and part of it is probably people aren't eating right. And of course, in Yemen, where you had you don't have as many people dying, but you have over 1 million cases in Yemen, one of the biggest epidemics in history going on. And this is, of course, political made, where I think right. certain regimes are very much to blame. But yeah, it's a scourge, and it remains a threat. And absolutely, you had a really strong epidemic in 2010 in Haiti as well. And of course, what happened was that the contagionist and the environmentalists started arguing. But I think the environmentalists are very correct that cholera lives in these places. Although I also think that the contagionists are correct that somebody is probably bringing in fresh microbes. So I think both things are going on. It's one of those issues where both sides are right, but certainly cholera lives in these places in a rather unfinished state. And then when it gets fresh microbes or it gets conditions in the weather, I think that's when it starts. It seems to me, I know of very few epidemics that were completely isolated, although there were some. There were some, and they're generally small epidemics. But I do think that it's both environmental and of course, we know it's contagious.
So I guess to the extent that famines are generally politically caused, then we could also, you know, observe that to some extent, cholera epidemics are politically caused.
I have to agree with that. You know, I'm sure there's somebody that's going to say, well, you have epidemics when there were no famines. I've not found any, but I'm not saying that there are none, but I think many cholera epidemics are politically caused. There's no question about it.
Well, John, we're about out of time here. So thank you for talking to me about your book. That was quite an interesting book to read. So thanks again.
Well, thanks for having me, Aaron. I really appreciate it. It's good talking to you again.
You bet. We'll see you later, John.
Okay. Take care, Aaron.
Okay, bye.
Bye.